Hi, I'm Rob, and welcome to the EdTech Podcast.
You've got a bit of the Liam Gallagher, haven't you? Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's the EdTech Podcast. Another busy week, first off moderating a panel at the Firefly Learning Conference entitled Are Parents' Evening and Reports a Waste of Time? In this discussion with teachers, head teachers, computing academics and parents, we looked at the role of continuous reporting, what is happening in industry with the step back from one-off and tense appraisal meetings, and considered how to build genuinely impactful face-to-face experiences between students, parents and teaching staff. One interesting idea was the idea of flipped parenting, providing parents with a generic data more easily so that parents' evening can talk through the child's development more personally. This brought me on to discussing accessing my own son's development at the nursery and uncovering that they are thinking of using a platform called Tapestry, which may make accessing information easier. Sometimes asking a question uncovers a whole new world. The panel ended before questions due to an impromptu fire alarm, with me helping to evacuate 400 people from the Rep Theatre in Birmingham. Congrats to Firefly on a great event, with Lord Knight keynoting and drawing on some of Linda Grattan's excellent work on how to live to 100. Last night I was at the latest demo day from UK Accelerator Emerge Education, with a really solid round of entrants and especially pleasing to see special educational needs and literacy covered off in a sector which doesn't always recognise these areas as readily as those in the investment-friendly STEM subjects. I'm looking forward to finding out more, and the aim of WAND and data are especially interesting in the context of this week's discussion. Congrats also to past cohort members Easy Peasy, who just released their efficacy study trials with Oxford University after intensive randomised control test in the early years space. A few quick updates to go. First off, I'm delighted to announce two more media partners working with the EdTech Podcast. First up, for those interested in EdTech publishing and content, FutureBook 2016 and The Bookseller, in collaboration with EdTech Exchange, are offering listeners a 20% discount on FutureBook 2016 tickets. You can register at www.thebookseller.com/FutureBook2016 and enter promo code PODCAST20. The event runs on Friday, 2nd of December in London. Next up, I'm delighted to announce that the EdTech Podcast will be joining ASU GSV as collaborative partners. If you're not familiar with ASU GSV, it's the combination of Arizona State University and GSV partners broaching the subject of education innovation, and previous speakers have included Bill Gates and Condoleezza Rice. The event runs next May 8th to May 10th in Salt Lake City, Utah, and the EdTech Podcast will be on site recording some of the most promising innovations and addressing some of the outstanding questions in EdTech. More details are available in the show notes. If Nordic adventures are more your thing, and I'm pointing at you now, Sam, at EdTech Exchange, then you'll be pleased to know I'm chairing the Nordic EdTech Conference on the 8th of December. If you'd like to find out more or join over 100 innovators from universities across the Nordic region, details and links are in the show notes. And finally, if you're into supporting young entrepreneurship and you're in London, you should get along to Julian Hall's Ultra Kids event at Here East on Sunday the 4th of December, featuring entrepreneurs as young as 8. Here East Education Manager Giselle Nanda will also be about saying hi. Right, news and events over, so straight into this week's podcast episode with former assistant head teacher Robert Eastman from Firefly Learning. We are in discussion about a new survey commissioned by Firefly from YouGov on the opinions of head teachers, deputy heads and SLTs at secondary schools on data transparency. In this episode, we cover what data do senior leadership teams want to access in real time, how are leaders tracking school-wide progress, and how are schools overcoming transparency, security, and time allocation issues. It's a great ramble chat, thanks Adam Buxton, taking in data and the aviation industry, great reads in this space, and past anecdotes on data in schools. I hope you enjoy. Do feedback at Podcast EdTech, and you can subscribe at iTunes, Stitcher, and Pocket Cast. Have a good week. Okay, so today we're in King's Cross and I'm here with Rob Eastman, Client Experience Manager at Firefly Learning. And we're in King's Cross because Firefly are based in Hammersmith and I'm based in Hackney, so it was a good compromise in the middle.
Halfway house.
Yes, indeed. And we're here today to talk about the findings of a new YouGov report Firefly have commissioned on data transparency in state schools. And for the benefit of those listening, I've done my homework. And Rob, you used to be an assistant head and head of digital strategy at the Duke of Kent School.
That's right, yeah.
And also, you completed a master's in educational leadership with a dissertation on introducing a virtual learning environment to schools, a case study. So I'm sure that was really helpful in the Firefly interview.
Actually, the Firefly helped me with the dissertation in the first place.
Ah, there we go.
Because I was introducing that VLE at the school. So I was able to use that as a model to work from. But I did happen to drop in that, do you know what? I've got this dissertation that you might want to read. But it was good. It gave me a good insight into what's working in schools and what isn't working in schools. That sense of, I had to critique and basically look at what I did that had gone really, really well and look at what had not gone so well and how I would do it differently next time. So it was a really interesting piece to do.
Jump straight back in with the YouGov reports. Firstly, can you tell us a bit about the process of working with YouGov on this report, who you surveyed and why you thought it was important?
So the group that we looked at really in the report was senior leadership, because we're now at the stage, I think, with EdTech where teachers are using it successfully. It's becoming more and more embedded in classrooms and we're seeing an impact in the classroom. But actually, the next step is we're getting requests from deputy heads and senior managers who it's all a bit vague and abstract. We know they're using it, and the kids seem to like it, and the parents are saying good things about it, and the teachers are all positive. But actually, we're not 100% sure how they're using it, what it is that they're doing. So I think that sense of, there is a sense of the investment. If we're going to invest time and money and effort in this, we'd like to know that it's being used properly. We'd like to get a sense of what's going on. Yeah. But also, actually, they're using it for students. Students are achieving results. Ultimately, you know, the education of the child is what we're about. And we want greater oversight in what is happening within that.
So going back to sort of being able to measure the impact as well, but also to track that investment as you would with anything else, I suppose, which is quite funny because the executive head teacher I just mentioned was talking about how she uncovered, after 3 months, a box full of 30 iPads that had never been used. So that's always, I suppose, an example of what we're talking about.
It's quite an expensive version of finding £5 down the back of the sofa, that is.
Yes, I suppose, yeah, so it's good and bad. Yeah. And the report, I believe, is on state schools, whilst my understanding of Firefly is that you have a more traditional reach with private schools. So my question there is, do you think state and private schools suffer the same problems when it comes to transparency?
Yeah, I think they do. I think, but for different reasons. So I think traditionally private schools have been able to be a little bit more able to step back from the whole league table process and constantly tracking and monitoring. And therefore, if they do monitor achievements of students or they are monitoring standardised tests, they're monitoring it for their own purposes as opposed to we need to feed this information to county councils and government and what have you. And so I think, although they're both trying to track it, they're both trying to track it for different purposes, I think the problem with, historically the problem in the state sector has been this issue with the sheer amount of data that they're being asked to collect. And state school teachers are very much under the cosh when it comes to the paperwork and the hoops they're having to jump through and stuff that actually is getting in the way of what you want to do in the classroom. And that's the biggest issue, I think, with data collection, is somebody's got to collect it. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you need the time to collect it, or you need a process that allows you to collect it easily, and you've got to have a really good reason for collecting it. And, you know, if I'm a classroom teacher, me providing all my homework sort of feedback and results and book scrutiny and all the lessons I do, if I'm providing that simply with the thought that actually they're going to look at this and they're going to give me grief over it, well then why on earth am I going to bother collecting it? So it's making it easy to collect, but then also having an awareness of what that data is going to be used for.
So that's really interesting, because I saw that when you asked the senior leadership teams what they could do that would improve school performance, they said, number one, reduce teacher workload. Number two, enable parental involvement in their child's learning. And number three, give students easier access to resources. And then that brought me back to, I suppose it's probably about a year or so old now, but the Government Workload Review Challenge survey, and that was of 44,000 teachers. And I think marking and data collection were two of the three working groups that came out of it. And what they found was that current data collection processes were very all-consuming for teachers. So, and exactly what you said, you know, perhaps people are collecting these huge swathes of what, you know, in inverted commas, big data, but not really with the view of why is this useful, or it's just ticking boxes. So, In that sense of things, how can we make data become part of the solution with workload, not part of the problem in teachers' minds?
So I think there's two strands to this. There's first of all, schools are already collecting a vast amount of data, and they're doing it actually as part of their day-to-day practice. So whether it's from external exam results, GCSEs, A-levels, any of those, whether it's from standardised testing that schools are doing with CAT testing or NFER testing or any of those things, that data is all being collected. Homework data is all being collected. Teachers are marking their books. Mm-hmm. So the homework that is set is there, the students' performance on it is there, and then the feedback that they're receiving from the teacher is there. So it's finding a system that allows you to collate all of that information very, very easily. We were chatting about the aviation industry and that whole black box process. And the amount of data that they're collecting about what the aircraft is doing, what the flight crew is doing, is astronomical. But they do it in such a way that it never impinges upon the actual flying of the aircraft. I mean, even down to the point they're recording the conversations that the crews are having in order to try and get some sense of why did they make that decision? Why did they take that action? And I think that's the trick, is being able to collect the data such that the teachers aren't having to do more to hand it over to you. But the performance of the student, if you like, that feedback process is only part of the equation, if you like. There's the other aspect, which is, all right, so what happened that got the student to bring about this performance? And so there you're looking at, I mean, you used to do things like book scrutiny, and you would do lesson observations as part of that ongoing process to see what is going on. It's incredibly time consuming. It can feel quite uncomfortable being observed. Talk to any teacher. Nobody wants to be observed. And so finding a system that allows you to get a bird's eye view of what's going on in the classroom, as well as, you know, a good IT solution will allow, that's what IT does. It gathers information and then is able to disseminate it. And so finding a proper IT solution that will gather the information that you need and from all the different sources that it might come from, but in such a way that there isn't an ongoing impact with teachers, and yet it's able to collect it from a wide variety and put it all easily accessible for SLT. And I think if we can crack that nut, well, we've got that part of it sorted out. Observation is slightly trickier, and I know schools who have dealt with it in different ways. I know a guy who was on my master's, actually. He was one of the lecturers on the master's, and he said they took the largest classroom in the school and basically chopped off about a third of it to put a viewing gallery into it. And it was a sort of two-way mirror, so people could sit in there. There wasn't a sense that you were being observed. And teachers were invited into this room to teach lessons and be observed. And initially, there's a sense of, why am I being observed? This isn't so good.
It is
a little bit. But actually, they did a whole thing. They did a whole mindset approach. No. If we're inviting you in here, it's because you're really good. And we want people to watch you and learn from what you're doing. And eventually, it almost became a bit of a badge of honor amongst the teachers. You know, have you been asked into the room yet? Teaching hospitals do it. They have theatre observation galleries where you can watch operations taking place. So I think that approach to being able to learn from what the best are doing, rather than we're watching you to see what you're doing wrong, it's a really good way of disseminating best practice.
Well, that's what we were talking about before we started recording, about in the healthcare industry, the same thing of this hesitancy to give up data. You know, is this going to be, you know, especially when you consider private healthcare, how is this going to mean that I'm ranked and that kind of thing? And actually, you know, the flip side of that is there is this huge move in patient safety to make data more transparent and give ownership back to whether it's heart surgeons. And, you know, it's a big move in terms of being brave to put that out there. But at the same time, if you're the actual patient in that situation, you know, that's the least that you want, really. So
The impact of it can be huge. I mean, again, looking at the whole, you know, the airline black box, and it was about 1912, aviation fatality rates were running about 25%. So, you know, you had a 1 in 4 chance of dying if you went in the air. And then 100 years later, sort of 2013, there were something like I think the stats are like 3.6 million commercial passengers, of which 210 died as a result of accidents. I mean, that's an astonishing turnaround, and it's because of their approach to data and how they use it.
And you recommended a book earlier on this subject.
Yeah, Matthew Syed, the Black Box Thinking. It's a really interesting approach to evidence-based strategy, effectively. And, you know, he uses, funnily enough, he uses the aviation industry. He talks about the health service and the health industry, but he also looks at sort of political systems and how it's used, whether it's used, but also how people respond to it. And he has that this two-pronged approach. You do need the right mindset. You do need to be looking about, this is about improvement. Mm-hmm. But as you said, you've got to be absolutely open with that data, because if you're not, everything you get, every decision you make will be flawed because you haven't got the whole picture.
And so I suppose there's a fear factor potentially from teachers, you know, is this data is it a persecution thing, or is it to help improve my practice? On the flip side of that, I suppose, how can transparency help with student well-being and mental health care?
I think, again, John Hattie talks about visible learning, and visible learning being a two-way street. I've got to be seen to be teaching, the student has got to see that I'm teaching them as much as I've got to see that they've making progress. And I think as well, it means that students can enter an educational process where the education is not imposed upon them. They have a better understanding of why they are doing these tests, why we are tracking their performance, and then how that is impacting upon their ability to progress. And that's not just your bright students, that's potentially your disaffected students who are dragged into school because the law says I have to. But actually, if I can see why this is important, why this might start to work for me, then, you know, potentially I'm much more likely to be engaged in the whole process. It removes some of the stress from it, because it removes some of that unknown. You know, if students can see that it's perfectly normal for grades and results to go up and down, that's what they do. And in fact, if you're achieving nothing but A stars consistently and nothing else, then am I doing my job correctly? Shouldn't I be challenging you a bit and giving you things where actually you're going to find it harder? You're not always going to be hitting top performance. So you're learning the importance of failure, if you like. It was a quote I came across recently, which was this idea of failing forward. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I was a science teacher, so for me, every failure is simply a step along the path to getting the right answer. But I think a lot of students are so tied up with this idea of success, the importance of success, that failure is massively stigmatized, and yet it's an important part of that process. And if they can see the data, and they can see their performance, and they can understand that, yeah, no, that's fine, you blipped in that one, but we know why, and we can look at what we need to do in order to rectify that, and then move it forward again, it's more transparent, it's more open, it's not a sense of, you know, what is going on, I don't understand what's happening to me, I don't understand why we're doing that. You should start to feel a little bit less stressed, a little bit more comfortable with that process. You're engaged in it better.
Okay. So just going back to some of the report findings, 47% of senior leadership team disagreed that the schools were using their existing technology successfully, in the sense of there wasn't the uptake of those technologies, or, you know, tracking of that having a positive impact. So my question to you is, whose fault is this? And because, you know, the investment continues, yeah, although it is slowing down, it does continue. So if that investment is going to happen anyway, how can we make sure that, you know, the impact and the use of that technology happens in a better way?
Fault's probably quite a hard word to throw at people, but I think there is a perception that IT and computers are the universal panacea. And if I buy enough computers and I buy enough iPads, everything's going to be fine. I did a blog post recently where I likened it to buying a car, and said, you know, if I bought a car and just thought, that's it, I don't need to learn how to drive, and I don't need to service it, really, the car's going to be absolutely fine. Actually, things wouldn't last very long. And that, I think, is the biggest issue with IT. People plop it in and assume it's going to fix, and it doesn't. The staff need to be shown how to use it, but not actually just these are the buttons that you press, but, you know, teachers have a complicated job, a job which changes all the time, and they need to understand why they should be pressing these buttons, in what context, how is this going to work for me, how does this sort of integrate with the way I teach. So they need loads and loads of context in their training, and they need to have a really good understanding. So training is an important part of it, but also what I referred to in the blog as the servicing of it. You need a team that's going to run it for you. You need a team, and it might be, you know, if you've got a cloud hosted solution, then that side of it might be fairly minimal, but you need to make sure that all of the other bits of your network that tie in with it are all running successfully, so that your cloud hosted solution works successfully. So there's two sides, and I don't think it's at fault. I just think it's potentially a lack of understanding that I can put this in, but I need to support it. In the same way that if I bring an NQT in to school, I can't just plonk them in a classroom and off they go. They will need support, and they'll need guidance in those first few years.
And do you find that most of that CPD in the schools that you work with comes internally from within the school, or is sourced externally?
It depends a lot on the school, and it depends on their budget, it depends on their time. CPD is a really difficult thing with schools, because it tends to be very cyclical. All CPD tends to happen at the start of term, which means that, you know, from our perspective, suddenly pretty much every school we've got wants trainers at the start of term. So that's not without its issues. Finding time in a working day, a busy, long working day, can be difficult at any other part of the term. So we find that we have some schools where you've got a project lead who is really switched on, really clued up, knows what they're doing. They will go in and do a lot of CPD themselves.
Yeah.
But in other schools where potentially that individual is very, very time poor, and it might not be a lack of ability or a lack of confidence, it might just be, do you know what, I don't have the time to do this. So they'll get somebody in to do it. Sometimes it's, we want to see latest best practice. And that's where an external agency is in a really good position, because they visit lots of schools. They see what lots of schools are doing, and they're able to kind of disseminate that information around. So a lot of it will depend on, you know, where the school is, you know, within their IT journey, if you like, and what it is they're hoping to achieve. So we've done sessions on just sort of standard Firefly use, if you like, but we've also done days where we've gone in and looked at schools launching flipped learning. So we've gone in and said, okay, well, here's flipped learning, let's introduce it to the staff, and now let's show you how Firefly can help you achieve what it is that you want to with that flipped learning strategy. Yeah. It's conflating technology with pedagogy, and they're not one. So I read recently, pedagogy is the driver, should be the driver behind anything you're doing in school, but technology can act as the accelerator. Mm-hmm. And that's the issue, is that you need a really good teaching strategy that you're going to take, and then you look at how technology can help you support that, accelerate it, really achieve it to the nth degree. But it won't replace that original teaching strategy. You need to have that solidly underpinning it.
So you referenced John Hattie earlier on, and again in the report he's also referenced, you know, how using data in instructional decisions can lead to improved learner performance.
Mm-hmm.
But the findings of the SLT that you surveyed is that 48% disagreed that currently data used allowed them to assess the quality of teaching and learning. So what's the disparity? Like, why is that caused?
So it's, if I go back to the thing we said earlier about that two-sided equation, that most of the data that's being collected easily is the summative data. It's that end point data, and that doesn't really tell you anything about the process that's led up to that. And so we need to find a way to see what it is that teachers are doing. There's another black box, which is, I think it's called Inside the Black Box publication, where they look at the classroom as a black box. No one really knows what goes on. And you feed in all these inputs, your teacher and your students, and we measure all these outputs, the performance, the achievement, the results the students are achieving. But what happens in there, it's magic. Nobody really knows, except possibly the teacher. And sometimes, I mean, I've taught lessons where it's gone like a dream, and I haven't got the faintest idea why. I've got no idea what I've done differently.
It's like much of life, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a fantastic experience when it happens, but you want to know why. You want to replicate it. And I think that's the data that we're missing. Is it's all very well knowing what happened, but we want to know why it happened. And that is, by its very nature, that is time consuming. You need to go in and watch them in action. Now, whether you have an observation gallery type arrangement that you set up so you can watch them, whether you have a room that is set to film so that you can film a lesson taking place from various angles, that's quite a nice approach. You don't have to be there and sit there for an hour. But you can, A, you can watch it at a time that suits you, but also you can share that with other staff within the school very quickly and easily, rather than them all having to come in and watch somebody at work. And
potentially with the student, you know, if it's reminding people about the lesson content, that kind
exactly.
of thing. There's a section of the report called Engaging Parents, where 49% of the SLT asked said they disagreed with their technology solutions, enabling parents to be fully involved with their child's learning. My provocative question here is, if you had your way, would you get rid of Parents Evening? And not because we want to not communicate with parents, but because we want to communicate with them better. I guess the equivalent's happening in industry, where some are getting rid of the idea of having a yearly catch-up and actually just saying, oh, let's just do this every week, and that should be how we know if you're on the right track. And from my experience, I was thinking about, you know, I have a young son in nursery, and I'd much rather know his nursery report updates via my phone or email than by a ring-backed folder which is sat on a shelf, and I have to kind of request to see that. It's not really an invited process otherwise.
Yeah, I've done parents' evenings from both perspectives. I know it's, I have two teenage daughters, and we've given up parents' evenings with them. We're lucky, they're both doing well, but actually we went along to the first one, and we were there for about 4 hours and managed to see three teachers in that time. Yeah. It's a very big school, and it was an absolute nightmare. And at that point, I came back, as you can imagine, in a great mood, muttering to myself that we're never ever doing that again. But then I've sat in parents' evenings, and we used to have sort of 10 minutes per parent or per family would come in, and you would start at 4:30 and you'd finish about 9:00, and you did not stop. They would literally come through like a conveyor belt. But that 10 minutes it wasn't a waste of time, but it could have been used so much more effectively. And if you think about, if we take it as a 10 minute sort of period of time, and we start to break up how that 10 minutes is used, and there'll be a reasonable amount of it we've taken up, so this term, this is what we've been doing. And then there'll be that, and that might be sort of 3 or 4 minutes of it. And then you might have another 3 or 4 minutes where you're looking at, and this is how your child's performing. Let's have a look at some of the work and the grades they've got. And then you'll have, say, 2 minutes left where you talk about, so what are we going to do next? And the really crucial part of that conversation is, what are we going to do next? It's also the only part that can really take place face to face.
Yeah.
All the rest of it, you can provide them with curriculum booklets or whatever you like, you know, documents, breakdowns, anything online which says this is what we're doing this term, so they can see that. If you're sharing homework feedback and, you know, standardized data with them, anything like that, then they can also see how their child is performing. So they could come to that parents' evening with all of that. So 6-7 minutes
flipped parenting
already
evening.
Done. Yeah, flipped parenting, if you like. And that means that you then have 10 minutes where you can talk about, okay, so they've done really, really well, how shall we stretch them, what would you like to do at home with them, that sort of thing. Or actually, you know what, we're not quite where we want to be yet, so let's agree a strategy. And ideally the child is in on that conversation as well, so you've got the child, the teacher and the parents all agreeing, this is what we're going to do to go forward in order to get the very best to make you feel more comfortable. And it might not even be, you know, I've taught kids very, very bright, but actually my concern with them was how they were interacting with their peers in the class. They were struggling, or they were very introverted. And so, do you know what? And I've had this conversation with parents. I'm not worried about him academically. I'm worried about him because he's struggling to get on with his friends. So that should be our core aim, if you like, over this next term, because at some point he's going to leave this nice safe school environment, go on to, you know, a much bigger school, or he's going to go to university, and it's going to be a difficult thing for him to pull up. So you can really focus on the all-round education because you've got time to do it. All the other bits, the bits that you don't need to be around for, that's all been dealt with already, again, by technology.
That's really interesting. And I guess how I'm imagining when those conversations currently happen, where you're trying to sort of broker a deal or a strategy or an agreement between the parents, senior leadership team and the student, is usually when it's got to a crisis point and you're in the head teacher's office and it's like a negative thing as opposed to...
And everyone's very, very flustered and very, very tense, and tempers are rising, but people aren't in a frame of mind to negotiate, shall we say.
Yeah. Very diplomatic. Okay, and then, so more than 80% of SLT said they would welcome daily access to student grades, attendance and departmental performance. What I wanted to ask you is, do you have a picture on how regularly, and obviously this depends per school or your sense of, they are currently accessing this type of information?
It will depend a lot, again, on the size of the nature of the school. I know some small schools, for example, the director of studies or the deputy head academic will be teaching a significant timetable, and so they'll be grabbing that data as and when they can. And that might be once a week, that might be once a month, that might be towards the end of term when you're tracking back and seeing what's happened. So that's simply a time issue, trying to balance that with everything else. A very large school where they've got someone who, that is the 90% of their role is to, you know, monitor teaching and learning and performance of students, they would be able to do that far more frequently. And again, it depends on the nature you've got coming through to you. If you're only collecting standardized data and, you know, exam results, things like that, then you're going to look at it when those results come out. And those come out, that's information, and it comes out, you know, three or four times a year maybe. But of course, by that point, it's kind of too late. A lot of the damage has already been done. But if you're able to track, you know, how a cohort is performing, even, you know, half-termly, and just have a quick track back and look at their grades and so on and so forth, then that gives you a much better indicator that if there is a move occurring, you've got time to respond to it. I was at Brighton, teaching in Brighton for a number of years, and we had sort of interim grades that went out, and they went out every 3 weeks. And I know the deputy head there, I know him very well, and I know that part of his job, and actually not just his job, actually what he wanted to do was just look at each child, and you're looking for patterns of behaviour. You're not looking for, right, this is a disaster because his grades have gone down by one sort of level, or, you know, it's not a cause for rejoicing because they're suddenly going up. It's a flag, and it's wondering why that's happened, mm-hmm. and then investigating, just seeing, okay, they've dipped. And it can be something literally as prosaic as the hamster died at the weekend, and therefore when he sat this test he wasn't feeling very happy, and so he wasn't focused on it. But it just allows you to keep an overview of what is happening, and if there are anything unusual taking place, then there's that flag coming up to say, we just need to find out what's happening here. Might be suddenly an entire class's grades are rocketing up. Well, that teacher might be doing something amazing. Or it might be the topic that they've chosen to do with them at this point has really engaged them. Mm-hmm. But find out what it is, because then you can learn from that. You've got that evidence. Let's learn from it.
In some schools, I mean, some of the larger MATs have a head of data person. Do you think other schools will follow in that direction? Or
it's a really good... I think it's a really good strategy to have someone to manage it, because we're talking about, you know, using data effectively. The more data you've got, the better. But if you've got a massive volume of it coming in, you do need someone to manage it and collate it, because otherwise it just swamps you. So you want someone who can actually collate it and then produce some sort of report which is immediately digestible. So I can look at it, and whether it's a graph or whether it's a table, whatever, but I can see what's happening without having to wade through reams and reams of data. We devised a database at the Duke of Kent when I was there. I created a database when I was there, and I did it very, very rapidly, because we used to record a lot of their interim marks on paper, and they went in files in a great big filing cabinet in the staff room. And I was trying to track how a child had been performing over a couple of years. And I go through these files, and eventually I've got the table, and I'm looking, I've got 15 separate pieces of paper on this table trying to track what has happened. And it's impossible. So at that point, I was very clear, right, if I'm going to do this, I need a data solution that is going to present this for me, at least allows me to pull up a child and just pull out the relevant pieces that I want from them. And again, you know, that's what computers do. They handle data. They handle different kinds of data, but they handle it. But I think having somebody, a data analyst, who they're not necessarily coming up with strategy from it, that might not be their role, but they are able to collate it and present it in an easily digestible format.
I also read another report recently, which is BISA's ICT in Schools report, which I think has come out over the last 30 years or so. And, you know, there's a great amount that's in agreement between the two reports. But one aspect that differed is in terms of data security.
Yeah.
And I think half of schools said they had concerns over security, especially when it comes to cloud-based solutions. So I didn't know what your thoughts were on that and how you're sort of dealing with, relevant concerns about whether it's student data or school data.
Well, there's some new guidelines, I think, have just been published. In fact, more than guidelines, I think schools need to adhere to them regarding the security of personal data.
Yeah.
We've worked very, very hard with whatever the relevant body is, and I can't remember that off the top of my head, to ensure that we are ticking every box as far as handling data is concerned. Part of the thing is, one of the things that we've got is, we are not the owners of the data, but we do process it. Obviously things like, you know, personal data regarding students and grades and things like that. But we have to have very robust processes in place to make sure that data remains secure. So for example, when I visit a school, I don't have a login as such to go in and do training. We have a support login, which in order to access that, I have to be logged into my Google account, and my Google account has to have a particular strength password, and it's double authentication and all sorts of processes. So it can be a headache when you go into schools and you've got no mobile signal and you're desperately trying to get your text to come through to tell you what your number is.
I've had the same trying to do Skype or VoIP recordings with their firewall. It's there's obviously all these things in place, but at the same time, when you're trying to convince or trying to support teachers or other educators have the benefit of technology, there are these sort of overzealous, from a user experience point of view, barriers, then it's trying to balance the two, isn't it?
I think there are. I mean, a classic is YouTube, and some schools will ban YouTube for the students, and I understand why, because once you get in there, you can get all sorts of things in there, and you have no, as a school, you've got no control over that at all. And yet it's such a shame, because I mean, YouTube from an educational video perspective is getting better. It feels daily it's improving. The amount of content that's on there is absolutely fantastic, but because of the other things that are on there, schools are understandably very cautious about letting students loose on it. There are various things about the firewalls that are in place. If you sort of wind back from YouTube, just letting the students on the internet, you will get, kids now are very, very IT savvy. And as they get older, you'll find kids who'll be spending their time trying to bypass this or bypass that in order. And they're not even necessarily doing it for nefarious means. They're doing it just because it's a challenge. Let's see if we can do this. But of course, the internet it's a huge place, and it's got everything from the sublime to the distinctly unpleasant. And I think to a certain extent, you can police it, in inverted commas, but I think there's also a job in education and teaching students what is not appropriate, when it might be appropriate, when it's not appropriate. And interestingly, I think students are getting better at that. I think the younger students in particular are much more savvy about controlling their online profile, making sure that they're safe online, because they've grown up with it. Whereas 10 years ago, it was a whole new thing to teenagers. They had no idea what they were doing. So as teenagers do, they were going out and making lots and lots of mistakes.
Whereas
I think the younger generation now are aware of these from a very early age, and they're much more savvy about it.
And it's just so young anyway, as a technology, that even adults, we're all getting used to the etiquette of how do you manage people's expectations on email or your own data trail and that kind of thing. So how can people connect with you?
Fireflylearning.com. I'm also on LinkedIn.
And what about the report? How can they access that?
So the report is going to be available on the Firefly blog. Again, we've got, if you look at all the schools and all the teachers just in this country alone, that is a massive network of intelligence out there. Lots and lots of strategies, lots of people learning and using things and doing brilliant things. And the anything we can do to facilitate that exchange in ideas means that actually we all benefit. We all move forward far more quickly.
And have you got any shout-outs that you'd like to make of people that you do think do amazing things out there that others should go and investigate? Or, there are other particular senior leaders that you think are doing fantastic things, or schools? Or
so some of the ones that stand out, there's Yvonne Mitchell at Fetties up in Scotland. They've done some fantastic stuff. I came across Graham Starkey down at Felton Fleet, so the other end of the country. Had a quick look at his site recently, and they've got some great stuff with student collaboration, student creating pages on their site, and then teachers commenting on that. So actually using it not just as a repository for information, if you like, but actually a working environment for the students to operate in. And then we've got my old friend Sheridan Masters out at Gerardong in Brunei. Poor old Sheridan stuck out there in Brunei, but they are doing everything from teaching and learning to running the school scuba diving club out there.
Oh, wow,
so
nice.
They've got some amazing stuff going on.
And just finally, top three reads. So that can be non-education based or education leadership stuff, or any books that inspire you that you want to share with other people. So you mentioned the Black Box one.
Okay, yeah. So most recently, Black Box Thinking. Really enjoyed that. What else? Phil Beadle has got a really amusing book.
Jeremy's brother.
I hope not. But if you search Phil Beadle, and it's basically an irreverent guide to teaching.
Okay.
But he's got some really, really worthwhile points in there. Some really good stuff that he makes. But he does it in a way which you just can't help laughing. If you've ever been a teacher, there's stuff in there which you'll completely identify with.
It's good stocking filler if you're friends that are teachers.
Yeah. And if I'm reading something which is, should we say, not self-improving, I'm a big fan of John Connolly, funnily enough, a fellow Irishman who writes some really good thrillers. So if I need to step away from the world of academia for a while, he's quite a good way of going about it.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much, Rob. It's been great speaking to you.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, don't forget to check out the Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram feeds for extras. And have a good week. Take care. Bye-bye.